The Des Moines Register finds Iowa 4-H accused of systemic racial and cultural discrimination. This hour, we'll talk with the reporters who investigated the story. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also this hour, Iowa's revamped ag-gag law faces a legal challenge. How earthquakes and Mars quakes are different. Katerina Sestarek on the legislative session before they shut down the shop. And IPR's Katie Pikus on Iowans returning to their flood-ravaged homes. Buckle up for your News Buzz. First, this news from NPR.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with six race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up later this hour, Iowa's revamped ag-gag law faces a legal challenge. Also, how earthquakes and Mars quakes are different. That's right, I said Mars quakes. Quakes that happen not on Earth, but on, yes, fill in the blank. But first, the network of youth organizations known as 4-H has undoubtedly made an impact on many, many lives over the years, over the decades. Perhaps you, your son or daughter, can testify to this. 4-H has over 6 million members across the country, ages 5 to 21. Iowa's 4-H is the largest youth organization in our state. It now stands accused of systemic racial and cultural discrimination. Joining me to talk about it, two journalists of the Des Moines Register who have been investigating this, Jason Clayworth, investigative reporter for the Register, Courtney Crowder, Iowa columnist for the Des Moines Register in our Des Moines studio. Courtney, Jason, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us.
Jason, can you start off? Give us, in broad brushstrokes, what did you look at and why?
Well, this story came about by us learning about some problems with, specifically earlier, late last year, with transgender issues. And in doing that project, looking at some of the problems, we learned of other complaints involving racial tension as well. And so we looked at a number of years. We focused on the last 5 years and in complaints and concerns that have been raised within 4-H from both members and volunteers in the organization.
Mm-hmm. Courtney, let's go to a lawsuit that is part that you covered here. And I believe you talked with the same individual that I did. He's the former head of Iowa's 4-H, John Paul Chasson Cardenas. Tell us what his lawsuit alleges.
Sure. His lawsuit alleges systemic racism and his supervisor's lack of any sort of plan to address that. So he is suing essentially for wrongful termination, and he is saying that his civil rights were violated because he brought up these issues of transgender discrimination, systemic racism, cultural insensitivity, and at every turn he says his supervisors ignored or actively didn't address these issues.
Mm-hmm. And this is interesting. Jason, back to you perhaps, that you point out in your article there that this takes place at a particularly sensitive time for 4-H. Explain that, because it's got a national dimension to it.
Right. The National 4-H organization is attempting to grow its membership. And one of the key ways that it has identified how to grow is through diversity. And so this is a pivotal time for the organization. And these tensions arise during that time. And it's another challenge for the group, both nationally and here in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. And there is this controversial directive from the president's administration on this quest for diversity, right?
That's correct. And this is what brought this issue to our attention to begin with, and that is there was a national directive on how to handle transgender issues, children that are transgender, and that was taken down by the Trump administration, and after it was posted and here in Iowa and other states were advised to remove that from their websites as well. And that really is what launched some of the problems that we're seeing with the latest investigation that we did that brought to light other issues that went far beyond the transgender issue.
Mm-hmm. And when we talk about the Trump administration directive here, Courtney, this is really where the first statewide Latino in the 4-H's over 100-year history, right? This John Paul Chazon Cardenas, this is where he's caught. So he is, how would you characterize that? Trying to increase the diversity of the 4-H, and what happens?
Sure, yeah. So the reality of the situation is, at least in Iowa, the state is rapidly diversifying. The demographics of our state are changing, and they're changing quickly. And in order to adapt to those, 4-H needs to be more open. And John Paul saw this and began to push it. Now, some would say he was overzealous on his push for civil rights and seeking civil rights and seeking diversification. But others would say it is simply the only way to keep this organization, which, like you said in your introduction, has saved lives. In fact, it's the only way to keep it going, because we have to 4-H, they have to be able to have enough members to sustain the club system as they see it. And the only way to do that is to welcome Latino and diverse youth into the fold.
Right. And the statistic you point to there is that the 11%, the amount that the membership in 4-H nationwide has fallen since 2012, but participation in minority groups during that time has increased due to these outreach efforts, right?
Right. And so you see counties that are reaching out to these groups, creating these flourishing clubs, and you see counties that aren't, you know, dying slowly. It's almost like watching a suicide in slow motion, because there is only one way that 4-H will go if they don't figure out how to welcome people from diverse communities into their fold.
Mm-hmm. I want to get to some of these other examples with you, Jason, in just a minute, but what did the former 4-H leader, Courtney, do specifically that was objectionable? What did he get fired for?
Well, you know, Iowa State released a statement that said it was, you know, following personal instead of large strategic goals, that he was at odds with some people in the state organization. John Paul would say that it was because he pushed civil rights. So, you know, Iowa State has denied us any further description of why they fired him. And now John Paul has filed this lawsuit. So I guess we'll see what the courts have to say, but it's very split on why exactly he was fired.
Mm-hmm. Okay, past this lawsuit, Jason, give us, in the couple minutes we have remaining, an idea of some of these other examples. You spoke with dozens of 4-H members and leaders, and you have numerous examples in your article at the Des Moines Register on their website. For instance, an Iowa teen allegedly calling a hotel maid the N-word at a 4-H conference. You talk about that in the article.
Right. So there are multiple examples. The N-word incident. There was a former employee who says he was passed over for roughly 10 jobs. He's black, and he believes it was because of his color. And we even have found an example of a woman who believes that she was discriminated against for being blonde and blue-eyed. So, I mean, the allegations are relatively widespread. We didn't write about each one that we found, but we did write about the ones that we felt helped tell the story of the struggles that this organization is facing.
Mm-hmm. One of those was a large cutout inviting Iowa State fairgoers to take photos. This is one of the things where you put your face through a hole in it to take photos with the phrase. It had a certain type of calf on there, and the slogan was, "Every calf deserves a white face." Now, that's pretty pretty striking there. But I think the explanation may be, Jason, I don't know what conclusion you came to, it may have been an innocent mistake.
Well, in the situation involving the white face, that was another organization. It was the Hereford Association that promotes cattle, and the white face is in reference to Herefords and their white face. I mean, what the situation of and why this was relevant to 4-H is that a poster had a poster that invited the public to take pictures with had pictured a child with a 4-H T-shirt, and we saw John Paul advocate that be taken down, and it was. But this is a situation where there's some disagreement about whether or not John Paul was in fact overzealous and went about his approach in a way that was unflattering to the organization, or whether or not he was what he did was a rightful and meaningful way to pursue the group's overall goal. And so that's really what we're in when we're talking about the lawsuit. We're talking about a personnel disagreement and maybe a management style. But underneath there were these examples of problems that exist in the organization. And it's important to note too that in speaking with Iowa State, they have Iowa State, for those who might not know, is their extension overseas 4-H, and they appear from what we have seen to have taken this issue quite seriously. They have done numerous outreaches, and the problems that we brought to their attention, many of them, some of the organization leaders did not know about prior, and so you know there it's whenever you have an organization that expands all 99 counties. There's a lot going on, and there are a lot of challenges that the organization is faced. The state organization is faced with meeting.
You and the Des Moines Register went into a lot of detail here. As I mentioned, dozens of 4-H members and leaders you interviewed, many documents you went through. Courtney, finish up by giving us your reflections when you zoom out from this minutia to the bigger picture. What are the takeaways you had? And Jason, join in there too quickly. We have a minute or so left.
Sure. I mean, I like the white face example. So a cardboard cutout with a girl standing next to a Hereford cow. Hereford cows are known for their white faces. And it says, every calf deserves a white face. And it invites you to get and stand in where the little girl would be. So you're like the little girl. And, you know, it's a perfect sort of example for what we're talking about, because at the end of the day, that is promoting a breed of cow that has a white face. And from what I know, it's what people actually refer to the cow as, you know, Angus's or white face cows. But when you put it on a poster and you put it in a public space, you have to consider what all of the words in that sentence means. So you find yourself again between the push and pull of tradition, something you've always done, something you yourself found no discrimination or harm in. Mm-hmm. In an ever-evolving multicultural world, what does that look like? And that's where 4-H is. How do you embrace generational roots that have loved this organization, an organization that has promoted good, and how do you take that and put it into this world that looks different than the 1800s, than the 1950s, than the 1980s? And it's a tough challenge, but one I think the people at Iowa State are looking to meet.
Very well put there to sum up. Look at the investigation. Find out so many parts of this investigation we didn't have time to talk about. Go to the Des Moines Register website. Look at Courtney Crowder's work along with Jason Clayworth. Very interesting. Find out a lot about 4-H and the changes it's going through. Courtney Crowder, Iowa columnist for the Des Moines Register, investigative reporter for the Des Moines Register, Jason Clayworth. Thanks for coming into our studio today.
Thank you for having us.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. While Iowa's revamped ag-gag law is facing a legal challenge, on Monday of this week, an animal rights groups filed a lawsuit to stop Iowa's new ag trespass law. It was signed into law by Governor Kim Reynolds last month. This comes just months after a federal court, remember this in the news, ruled that the state's previous ag fraud law was unconstitutional. A law that was meant to effectively criminalize undercover investigations on livestock farms. Joining us with some background and analysis here, Jennifer Zwagerman is Associate Director of the Drake Agricultural Law Center. You were on just last week. Jennifer, glad to have you back.
Thanks for having me again.
So tell us, on March 14th, Governor Reynolds signed this new ag trespass law designed to protect agricultural operations. What's different, what's similar between this law and the previous one?
Well, both of them still basically criminalize the idea of lying to gain access or employment with some sort of agricultural operation. The key difference here is that it added, the new law added kind of a layer, and that requires this intent to cause harm to a whole list of things, whether it be the operation or animals, personnel, and importantly, the business, which could cause economic or include economic or reputational harm as well. And so the new state law was really kind of narrowed in a sense to try and remove some of the constitutional challenges. But again, it still really focuses on gaining access to agricultural operations through false pretenses.
Jennifer, we did an entire program on this a while back. I wanted to play a little bit of audio just so we get a sense of the two sides here. Here's Mike Telford. He's executive director of the Iowa Farm Animal Care, AFAC. This is an organization that self-identifies its aim as making sure every Iowa farm animal receives proper humane animal care. He's concerned about undercover investigators gaining employment at Iowa farms and facilities, and he doesn't agree with their motives for seeking employment at these facilities.
And I think that you have to ask, what's the motive behind people who shoot these videos? What is their goal?
Mm-hmm. Well,
and it's certainly not, unfortunately, Ben, it's certainly not animal care. I find it interesting that these are almost always carried out by someone promoting a vegetarian diet, and they think that everybody else should be on that diet.
Now, juxtapose that with Liz Pashaud, former undercover investigator with Mercy for Animals. She worked in Iowa as an undercover investigator for 6 months in 2011, right before the original ag gag bill was signed into law. Here's her response on that program we did a while back when I asked her about whether she lied when applying for a job at an ag facility in Iowa.
No, we never lie. And in fact, it's already pretty well documented that there are protections for employers against employees who lie on job applications. That was never part of our tactic because, frankly, it sullies the integrity of the investigation. So I used my real name, I used my real job history, my real social security number. Everything was verifiable. If anyone had done a background check or done some even basic Googling, they could have found out what my background was. And I gained employment through fully legal means, just like anybody else.
Right, but I guess the question is, you did not share your status as an investigator with Mercy for Animals. You didn't put that on the application, and so the employer assumed that you just wanted a job.
That's correct.
Okay, so there, Jennifer, we have sort of the two sides, roughly, their points of view. How is the, it was in January that the U.S. District Court of the Southern District of Iowa in Des Moines ruled that the original law was a violation of free speech. What about this new speech? This new case, how is it going to be viewed by the court? A little more detail on that.
Well, it is going to be different. I mean, the original case has been appealed, so that is still out there.
So we have these two tracks.
There are two tracks going forward right now. The first case is on appeal to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, which covers this whole region, including Iowa. And the new law is back in court at kind of that lower level. And it is going to require the court to kind of take a different look, but you're still talking about the same question, which is free speech and your First Amendment access to basically go undercover and conduct these types of investigations. And the question is, you know, Idaho had something somewhat similar in its ag gag legislation that was not overturned. And Iowa's hope is that the district court here in Iowa is going to view similarly, that this is narrowly tailored enough, that mm-hmm. it's focused enough, that it meets state interests to have this type of limitation, and that this is going to be basically an exception to that First Amendment free speech.
So what is the word? What is the change, the words in this new law that make it perhaps acceptable? We'll have to see.
The big focus here is this intent to cause harm, and that if you are lying or gaining access to this facility with intent to cause harm of some kind. And really it comes down to this idea of, if you are lying to gain access, is your intent to cause harm to the business reputation? And if you release footage, is it going to cause economic harm in a way that would not have happened otherwise? Mm-hmm. And so the intent of the person going undercover or gaining employment to investigate is really what's going to be the focus here. But that intent to cause harm really distinguishes it from that first original law.
Mm-hmm. I don't think Liz Pashaud, the clip we heard from that former undercover investigator with Mercy for Animals, would say there's an intent to cause harm. But she did say what she felt was the impact of the videos that she and others have recorded for Mercy for Animals.
We always find that after an investigation, there's an uptick in consumer engagement and watchdog activity in general over food safety and animal protection. We also often see that grocery stores, under pressure from consumers, will change their purchasing behaviors in a way that is more aligned with the values of consumers for the protection of animals and food safety.
Mm-hmm. So, Jennifer, this has had an impact.
It does. And I don't think anyone would argue that any type of undercover investigative report, that is the point of it, is to raise awareness of issues, inform consumers, help to force change.
Where does our food come from?
Exactly. And it's, a question of are you trying to change maybe some bad practices at one entity, like on one particular farm, the industry as a whole, our food system as a whole? But that's really the goal of going, I think, undercover for most of these, is to gather information. And that's what's the argument here, is we're going to be prevented from doing that, or investigators and would be prevented from doing that.
What if any other industries, we're just speaking about the ag industry here, specifically in Iowa, what if any other industries have similar protections that this law affords the ag industry here in Iowa?
There really aren't any that have this level of protection. I think I mentioned back in January that North Carolina's law that is kind of similar to this is one of the few out there that is much broader and includes really any sort of business or entity where somebody is going undercover. But that's currently being challenged right now as well. But here in Iowa, there really aren't any other industries that, when it comes to this type of investigative reporting and undercover investigations, have that same type of protection.
Well, which begs the question, of course, why should this be the exception?
Well, part of the argument is that there's a biosecurity. That's what mm-hmm. part of the state argument is, that you look at the risk of disease and the ease of transmission for some of these diseases, that biosecurity and animal health requirements require that you are very careful about who you let into the operation, and that people who are going undercover may not have that same concern that others would have.
Okay. Jennifer Zwagerman, thanks for coming into our studio.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Associate Director of the Drank Agricultural Law Center talking there, if you just joined us, about Iowa's revamped ag-gag law facing a legal challenge. When we come back after a short break, we'll talk about how earthquakes and Mars quakes, yes, quakes that happen on the planet Mars, are different. Katerina Sestarek on the legislative session before they shut down the shop in the next few days, and Katie Pikus on Iowans returning to their flood-ravaged homes and businesses. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events, including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Still to come, a legislative update as the legislature winds down from Katerina Sestarek in just a few minutes. But first, you could call it an earthquake on Mars, but that would be incorrect. Marsquake. Marsquake is the correct term. There's a new word for your vocabulary today. NASA's Mars InSight lander has measured and recorded for the first time ever a likely Marsquake. Bill Barnhart joins us, Assistant Professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Iowa. Bill, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me again.
I hope you're the right expert because you're a professor of Earth and Earth Sciences. We didn't have a Mars Sciences guy, so we'll talk with you, okay?
Sounds good to me.
What did the Mars lander detect and when?
So on April 6th, the Mars lander with its seismometer, which is one of several instruments on the InSight lander, detected a Marsquake. So a seismic event from deep somewhere inside of Mars that has been termed by many as a Marsquake. And this is, it's actually one of four events that have been detected since the instrument was deployed in late November of 2018. But the one that's been making big splashes in the news is the largest of these, and it is the first seismic events that have been detected on Mars.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know, did we have any idea if there were quakes on Mars before this?
There was an idea that there was because there were actually seismometers deployed on the moon during the Apollo missions, and similar events were detected on the moon. So this seismometer was put on the InSight mission to determine if these events happened on Mars.
Mm-hmm.
There was a seismometer previously put on Mars by one of the Viking missions, but it wasn't installed properly, so it never returned any data. But there was an idea that maybe you'd be able to detect these so-called Mars quakes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so how does this quake on Mars compare with what we have on Earth, earthquakes?
Well, first of all, the event that was detected in early April is extraordinarily small. Here on Earth, we actually would likely not have been able to have detected it because of all of the seismic noise caused by things that exist on the Earth that don't exist on Mars. So people, oceans, things that generate a lot of seismic noise make the Earth seismically noisy, and those don't exist on Mars. Mars is about 1,000 times more seismically quiet than the Earth is, so they were able to detect this very small event. Another key difference, too, is that there's not plate tectonics on Mars. We have plate tectonics here on Earth, and that drives most of the earthquakes that we're familiar with. And so the question is, well, how do you get an earthquake or a Marsquake on Mars? And the leading hypothesis is that it's related to cooling of the planet. When planets form, they're very hot on the interior, and they cool over time. This cooling process is actually why we have plate tectonics right now on Earth. And as the planet cools, it contracts, and that generates stresses and potentially generates these Marsquakes.
Mm. So just to go into, make sure we all understand plate tectonics, these are on Earth, they are these sort of rigid plates, and we're kind of floating on rigid plates, so to speak, over mantle, which is liquidy or not as rigid, right?
Right, yeah, you want to think of mantle as really hard peanut butter, so pretty hard but still able to flow, and that convex over very, very, very long time scales, millions of years, and that drives plate motions, and we ride on top of these rigid plates.
Okay, and so to take your peanut butter analogy, we're going to go to Mars, and the peanut butter in Mars is cold.
Yeah, it's colder than the peanut butter here. It still might be... slightly, it still likely has some viscosity to it, so it can flow. But it's probably pretty hard. Not enough that it's not flowing fast enough that you would actually drive the process of plate tectonics.
Okay, so what does this mean that the relatively little seismic activity on Mars does that forecast what's in store for the Earth? Are we cooling like Mars would have in the past and continues to do?
Yeah, eventually the Earth will cool enough that plate tectonics will shut down. The great analogy for this is actually Venus. There's very, very good evidence that there was plate tectonics at some point in the recent geologic history of Venus in, say, the last billion years, if you want to use that as a recent term. But it no longer has plate tectonics. And the reason for that is that Venus is just slightly smaller than the Earth is, so it can cool faster than the Earth did. And eventually, the Earth will cool down enough in several billion years that there will no longer be plate tectonics here, but we still might be able to generate earthquakes through these cooling processes and these contraction processes.
Mm. Fascinating. Bill, before we go, I have to hearken back to the last time you were on this program. You were on in December of 2018, December of last year. We spoke about the powerful earthquake in Alaska. That was a 7.0 magnitude quake. It struck just north of Anchorage. We spoke with you. We also spoke with an Iowan who was in Alaska and felt that quake. Has your department, have you been involved in the analysis of that?
Yeah, my research group, we continued analysis of that earthquake using a combination of on the surface of the Earth GPS sensors, as well as satellite imagery, and we were able to put together as accurate as we could a model of the earthquake in the subsurface, and we passed that information on to the U.S. Geological Survey, and they were able to use that information to provide better impact estimates of the earthquake itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, so it's driving the question I wanted you to answer before we go is, what are you looking to answer when you do post-game analysis of a big quake like that?
there's a lot of questions. The main societal question is where did it shake people the strongest? And if you don't have instruments on the ground to measure that, then you don't know, so you have to predict where it happened. So what we try to do is we try to create these three-dimensional models of the earthquake, which can be used to predict shaking, which can then be used to better inform these impact estimates. So we're thinking about how deep was the earthquake, how big was the surface area of the fault, which way is the fault inclined into the Earth? Does it incline to the south or to the north? And then how much slip was there? So those are all sort of the questions that we here at the University of Iowa try to address and then pass that information on to other users.
Bill Barnhart, you have a fascinating field of study. Thank you for sharing some of it with us today as it pertains to the news.
Thank you so much for having me again.
Bill Barnhart, Assistant Professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Iowa.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Now it's time to check in with IPR's state government reporter, Katarina Sestarek. And we are winding down the legislative session, Katarina, aren't we?
Yes, Ben.
Let's talk about, I understand, budget negotiations today, specifically the Health and Human Services budget had some happenings today. What can you tell us about that?
Right. So this is going to be the budget that is going to be, it looks like going to be the biggest fight of the year because Republicans in the Iowa Senate are adding some controversial amendments to it at the very last minute here as lawmakers are trying to wrap up the session. And so one of these amendments would amend the Iowa Civil Rights Act to say that public entities like the state or local governments are not required to pay for sex reassignment surgeries. So that would be through health insurance coverage or any reconstructive or plastic surgeries for intersex people and those with gender dysphoria. And the Iowa Supreme Court recently decided unanimously that Iowa Medicaid must cover these surgeries. So it's in response to that. And Republicans say that this move would save the state millions of dollars, but others say it's really impossible to estimate that. And other cities and states have not had success in estimating what the cost of that really is. And the other amendment that's controversial is it would block funding for Planned Parenthood to provide sex education programs in the state because Planned Parenthood provides abortions, and many Republicans want to pull as much funding from Planned Parenthood as they possibly can. And this is something that was tried, they tried to pass last year and were not successful.
Okay, we'll look for your reporting later in the day about how those budget negotiations, those amendments are turning out. Let me ask you quickly about the Republicans in the Iowa legislature voting this week to limit the Attorney General's authority, Democratic Attorney General's authority to pursue out-of-state lawsuits. This is why.
Excuse me?
Our Attorney General here in the state joined some legal challenges of the Trump administration's policies, and so this is what Republicans are doing in response?
So Republicans wanted to limit the Attorney General's power to join out-of-state lawsuits because they are frustrated that the Democratic Attorney General has been joining legal challenges, multi-state legal challenges against Trump administration policies. And so the Republicans say that the Attorney General should have to get permission from either the governor, the executive council, or the legislature to pursue these lawsuits or to just sign on as a friend of the court. And Democrats are saying that that is an overreach by the Republicans, and that some even said that Republicans are drunk on power. And so this is something that was approved by the House and Senate, and so it's now on the governor's desk.
Mm-hmm. Okay. This week also, in Iowa legislature news that was covered by the national media, the longest-serving Republican in the Iowa legislature announced he's switching to the Democratic Party. This is Representative Andy McKean of Anamosa, first elected way back in 1978. Why did he say he was defecting to the Democrats?
He said that he was increasingly uncomfortable with the positions that the Republican caucus in the Iowa State House was taking on a lot of different social issues and other just hot button issues. He said that the Republican Party has moved further to the right than it was back in the 70s and 80s when he was first in the legislature. And he kept thinking that he was more sympathetic with what Democrats were saying. And so he also said that he didn't feel, as a Republican, that he could put his support behind President Trump in the upcoming 2020 election. And so he said he thinks the country will start to pay a heavy price for Trump's policies and rhetoric. And he just couldn't support that.
Mm-hmm. The reaction from Republican lawmakers there?
Well, the House Speaker, Linda Utmeyer, who was sort of his leader when he was a Republican, said that she respects his decision and that they will move on with their conservative agenda. They now just have a slightly narrower majority in the House.
Mm-hmm. Jeff Kaufman, I see in your reporting, had a different tone. He called it, this is the head of the Iowa GOP, called it deception, what Representative McKean was doing, right?
Right. He called it deception. He said that Representative McKean rode Trump's coattails in the 2016 election and that there would be a lot of opposition to him if he chooses to run again as a Democrat in that district. But, you know, we'll just have to wait and see what happens there.
Okay, when will the session close? Do we have a good take on that at this point, Katerina?
Well, lawmakers are hoping to wrap up this weekend. I've heard a lot of different estimates. I've heard people say we're going to have a couple late nights left, and with these additions to the Health and Human Services budget, that will certainly take probably many hours of debate. So still not clear when this will all wrap up.
Okay. Katerina Sestaric, IPR State Government Reporter, thank you so much. And I want to remind you, thanks, Katerina. Remind you, on Monday, Katerina and I will be also hosting other journalists who are tuned in to the State House happenings. Kay Henderson of Radio Iowa, Barbara Rodriguez, the Des Moines Register, and James Lynch of the Gazette will be joining us Monday for the full hour as we look to a wrap-up or near-wrap-up of the 2019 legislative session. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A NewsBuzz edition, quick conversations to end the week on this Friday. Well, still recovering and assessing the damage from last month's widespread flooding in western Iowa. Joining us to give us an update, Katie Pikus, IPR's Western Iowa reporter. Katie, hi.
Hey, Ben.
Well, let's go through some of the communities, give us some pictures. People should really go online to see your reporting at iowapublicradio.org. I was there to see some of the pictures, especially that you took of Hamburg and the motel owners there wearing a filter mask to guard against the mold. The images speak loudly. But tell us first about the community of Hamburg in southwest Iowa.
So these were pictures taken in early April. So water has gone down a little bit since then, but the community of Hamburg actually lifted its evacuation earlier this week. So people are allowed to return home, but I have heard from a couple of homeowners who live near a levee that say they cannot get back right now.
Mm-hmm. Can't get back. What, the roadways are still blocked, infrastructure down?
around the county. Roadways are still blocked. Some roads are just in total disrepair right now. Still some water in some places, all that kind of stuff.
Right. And what are people returning to after the water was there, then has receded? I mentioned mold is a big problem, isn't it? And aside from the physical damage.
Yeah, so mold is a big problem. I mean, take this Motel Hamburg Inn that I visited in early April. Just really, really thick, sticky mud on all of the floors, mold on the ceilings. You know, picture kind of a very dimly lit room, and just to walk into that and to see mud just covering everything.
Mm-hmm. And I believe we have a little bit of audio. You spoke with Bob Patel and his wife?
I did. I spoke with Bob and Tina Patel. They have owned the Hamburg Inn for 13 years. They actually live at the motel, too, so it's their business and their home. And when we walked in, it was their first time seeing it in early April. Bob said, it looks like it's a total loss, and rebuilding this is not possible. So I asked them, you know, what is going through your minds seeing all of this damage? And they said, it's just totally heartbreaking. So let's hear what they had to
all
say.
All these 13 years, we work hard for this, renovate this motel. We put all our profit back in here to improve our facility. But now it's all gone.
Now we have no business, no work, no house, nothing, no
house.
Money. So we don't know what we're going to do.
It was our primary or secondary, whatever you said. This was our living too.
I mean, this hotel was your life.
Yes, it was our life.
Yeah.
And our kids grown up over here.
Yeah, this community, this town is very, very nice and helpful with us, but I don't know what we're going to do now.
Okay, heartbreaking indeed there, Tina and Bob Patel, Iowans you spoke with, Katie Pikus in Hamburg. Before we go, quickly in a minute, tell us about other places. Fremont County, Mills County, those are the extreme southwest counties of Iowa. What shape are they in?
So, In Mills County, north of Fremont County, evacuations have been lifted, but a spokeswoman for the county told me there are still lots of homes, like in Pacific Junction, that are inaccessible. So though the evacuations have been lifted, just like some parts of Hamburg, there are still people that cannot get back.
Okay. We'll look forward to your further reporting as you look at the aftermath, the recovery, assessing the damage from last month's widespread flooding in western Iowa. Katie Pike, is so glad you're there in western Iowa to give us the scene, the human tragedy there, people returning to their homes and having to rebuild. Thanks, Katie.
Thanks, Ben.
And as we finish up this News Buzz edition of River to River, always like to groove into the weekend. An interesting weather weekend we have. Dennis Reese telling us about that a few minutes ago. Mark Simmet of IPR's Studio One Tracks host. Mark, hi.
Hello, Ben.
You know, if we have some inclement weather, why not go to Studio One Tracks, right?
Well, yeah, anytime.
During the week. What do you have to groove us into the weekend?
Well, I've got something here from George Benson. This is a familiar name to music fans. He's had a long career as a guitarist and a vocalist. And his latest project, it's called Walking to New Orleans, and it's a tribute to a couple of music legends that passed in 2017, Chuck Berry and Fats Domino. It kind of mixes up their music on this one release that he has out, just came out, actually. And I chose a track that's one of the Chuck Berry compositions, and it's not, you know, the rock and roll Chuck Berry that he is most well known for, of course, you know, Johnny Be Good and so on, mm-hmm. although George Benson does that as well on the album. This one's got a Caribbean flavor to it, and I think George Benson does a really nice job. It really suits him well. It's Havana Moon.
Me all alone with jug rum, stand and wait for both to come. It's long the night, it's quiet the dark. The boat she laid since 12 o'clock. Me watch the tide.
Very nice. George Benson's been around a long time, but has that knack. We have time for one more, Mark. What do you want to take us out with?
Well, this next one is an instrumental track from a band that does nothing but instrumentals. And in the radio business, we're always looking for good instrumentals, you know, to fill in places here and there. So here at Studio One, we are familiar with the Budos Band, a band out of Staten Island, New York. Their new album is called Five, their fifth release. And being an all-instrumental band, you know, they really need to expand their palette musically to keep things interesting. And I really like this track on their new album. It is called Old Engine Oil.
Us into the weekend and giving us a good deal of energy there, Mark, at the end. Thanks so much.
Just feel free to let that run all the way to the end.
We will do that. The Budos Band, Old Engine Oil, picked out by Mark Simmet, IPR Studio One Tracks host. Make sure you check out Studio One during the week, on the weekend, anytime. An awesome way to get introduced into new music and old standards, old favorites like George Benson. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Caitlin Harrop. We had help today from Lulu Dewey. I think this is Lulu's last day. Thank you so much, Lulu. We've appreciated all the hard work and just working around you. John Pemble helped us out in Des Moines. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer.